For the benefit of those who've not been in the class, let me briefly go back and point out what we've been doing, and it's a good refresher for all of us. We started out looking at attitudes, actually, that affect our conclusions. This can be a very emotional and volatile subject, and our attitude toward truth is extremely critical. But then we began looking at definitions of words, marriage, divorce, adultery, fornication, those four words. If we don't have the correct definition, it will lead to miscommunication instead of communication between us, but more importantly, between God and us. And so it's critical to have those words defined. You cannot find the biblical definition, however, by going to a dictionary, because the dictionary defines words as we use them today. And they're not telling you what the Bible writers or speakers meant when they used those words. And so we've defined those words by contextual usage. We've looked at the place that word occurs and the things around it that are being said that help define what the author or the writer or speaker meant. So, using those definitions, we then began to study the pertinent verses. And now we're in a section of our study where we're looking at various views that are held about marriage and divorce and see if the things that we have learned help us deal with these various positions that are held on the subject of marriage and divorce. Now, you'll see on your lesson we have positions. We're simply saying that different people believe these things, sometimes as gospel preachers. And sometimes these men are men we respect and love and can preach great sermons. But that doesn't mean because a fellow can preach great sermons and that we respect him that he's right on every subject. And so we need to test everything we hear. Examine all things, 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. The Bereans search the scriptures daily to see if the things being said were so. And that's the way that we can test all that we hear. Alex, would you walk to the back and offer these to some of the folks that just walked in? This is lesson number 18. If you don't have a copy, Alex will be glad to give you a copy. All right, so the first position we're looking at, I have a brief paragraph that hopefully describes it sufficiently. Adultery is committed the first time one cohabits with any other person to whom he was married. When we studied adultery, this was critical. We'll see this as we look at this. The way the Bible defines adultery, it is not what happens at the courthouse. It is not legal papers that are filed. It is a sexual act. And at least one of the persons involved in the act is still bound by God's law to someone else. And we saw that in Romans chapter 7. That is a sexual act. We looked at through a number of verses where the word occurs. That shows that's what's in view. Well, this position says adultery is committed the first time one cohabits with any other than the person to whom he is first married. So two people are married. One of them has an affair, sleeps with somebody. That's adultery. That, according to the position, destroys the first marriage. Now, let me stop with you a minute. Marriage is a relationship. And there are two things necessary to this relationship. One, a covenant. Two, consummation of the covenant and sexual union. So, the person has an affair. That destroys the relationship, does it? No. Now, it's the prerogative of the person who's innocent, when they find out about it, to put them away, to destroy the marriage, to end the relationship. But the act doesn't end the relationship. It doesn't sever the covenant. That may follow. It may not follow. So this is right here is a statement that's simply incorrect if we understand the word marriage. Then it says, and so the marriage has ceased to exist. Now here's the fundamental idea of this view. It is not possible to adulterate that which does not exist. Do you remember anywhere in the Bible that that word is used to adulterate something? I don't either. That's our terminology. When a person commits adultery, they have polluted a relationship that is pure and holy. And we've developed a word that reflects that pollution, adulterate. And we use it relative to stuff we drink. Has your milk been adulterated? Your water been adulterated, polluted in some way? That's our terminology. But the idea that adultery pollutes the marriage, that's inherent in this particular position. I will agree, adultery pollutes the marriage. But, he says, therefore the marriage does not exist. The marriage doesn't exist. And so he says, therefore, subsequent sexual intercourse between them is not adultery. So, when the adultery is committed, the marriage doesn't exist. You can't adulterate that which doesn't exist. Therefore, all subsequent sexual intercourse is not adultery. Because, note the for there, they are no longer the husband or wife of someone else. So adultery, in this view, is to have a sexual act with someone who is the wife or husband of someone else. That relationship was severed when adultery took place. So any sexual act between the two people now involved would not be adultery. So let's go back to our verses here in Romans chapter 7. Now, you remember that we put these little notes throughout the lesson, C13, that's class 13. If you don't have a hard copy, you can go on the web while he's posted the lessons. And you can not only download a hard copy, but you can actually hear the audio of that class. So class 13, we talked extensively about Romans chapter 7. So this would be actually a brief review applying it to this particular idea. So, does the text in Romans 7 say this woman is an adulteress because, well, let me stop a moment. Does Romans 7 say this woman, after what she did, is an adulteress? Verse 2. The answer is yes. But it's that because. Is she an adulteress because the first marriage exists? Now that's the position. Does the text say that? It does not. It doesn't say that. Be careful of reading into the text something that's not there. Okay? And when someone I don't care whether it's marriage and divorce, whether you're talking about the work of the church, whether you're talking about instrumental music, I don't care what you're talking about. What we'll find ourselves doing if we're not careful is answering an argument that's not an argument to begin with. It's an assumption. And so somebody says, she's an adulteress because the first marriage doesn't exist. Okay, prove it. Where's the verse that says that? Then we'll look at it. The text does not say that, nor does any text on marriage and divorce say that. That's an assumption, unprovable assumption. So, in the text, however, we do have a reason given why she will be an adulteress. Verse 3. She'll be called an adulteress. That she'll be recognized for what she is, an adulteress. Okay, in the text, here's the reason given. So then if, see those first three words of verse 3. What he's going to say in verse 3 is conditional on what he said in verse 2. They logically depend on one another by those three words. So then if. So what he said in verse 2 was, she's bound legally by law, God's law, not court law, not United States law, God's law. Bound by law to her husband while he is living. That's God's law. So then if, verse 3, while her husband is living, she is joined to another man, which is marriage, she should be called an adulteress. So she's married to one man. Is she bound to that man? Is she married to? No. Who is she bound to? The first husband. As long as he lives. He says, that's why she's an adulteress. So then if. Watch. He further clarifies it. If the first husband dies, so why is she an adulteress? You still have this first man in the picture. She's bound to him. Let's remove him from the picture. He dies. Look what happens. She is free from the law. What law? Verse 2. The marriage law. The jurisdiction of the marriage law. He's talking about jurisdiction of law, as you see in verse 1. She's free from the law. Has anything changed with her? Nothing. She's still married to this guy. She still sleeps with this guy. Same guy. But now the man, the first husband's out of the picture. And so she is not an adulteress. What? What has she changed? Nothing. Nothing. Now, is she still guilty of adultery? Yes, the past acts of adultery. But when she sleeps with this man tonight, it will not be adultery because she's not bound by law to somebody else. And so there's the definition for adultery. So this idea in this position that adultery, if the first time, if that's correct, when this woman slept with that man the first time, she would not be an adulteress anymore. Tomorrow night, the next night, next year. But verse 3 says, she's an adulteress how long? As long as that first fella lives. That's how long. Because she's bound by law to him. So, that's an answer. And that stresses the importance of defining the term marriage. If you remember, we talked about the term marriage. She's joined to another man as the New American Standard. Some versions say she becomes another man's. King James says she marries another man's. It's not the normal word for married, but it's marriage that's in view. We looked at that when we studied Romans chapter 7. Yes, sir.
I just have a question for him back up to position. For those who hold this position, if a person in his marriage, first marriage, has an affair, it's adultery. By this position, marriage no longer exists. They reconcile. Does that mean that you go back to have a wedding ceremony?
Okay, Wally has a good question. So if this position is correct, here's his question. One of the parties commits adultery. If adultery destroys the marriage doesn't exist. But the person who committed adultery is sorry, seeks reconciliation, and they reconcile. Now what do they have to do to be married again? Do they just start living together again? Remember, they're not married according to this position. They're not in the relationship anymore. Do they have to have another wedding ceremony, go back to the courthouse, get some more papers? So that's a good question. Of course, the fact that the person committed adultery does not in and of itself sever the marriage. Now, if that first mate divorces them, and later there's reconciliation, to reestablish the marriage, what has to take place?
Renew the covenant.
Marriage involves a covenant and sexual consummation of the covenant. Suppose, and this is a real life scenario I'm presenting to you. Obviously, I'm not going to give the names. Adultery's committed. So the person puts them away. But that person who put them away wants to keep sleeping with them. Is that okay?
No.
They've got to make up their mind what they're going to do. You sleep with somebody that you don't have a covenant of marriage with, what is that called?
Fornication.
That's right. And so that's not hypothetical. We've actually dealt with that kind of a situation. Yes, sir. I'm sorry, Mark, speak up. Okay. Well, I've dealt with an argumentation. Most folks don't like it too much. This idea of a false or missing premise. The way we reason, we state a premise and we reach a conclusion. But that's not logic. There's a premise and there's a second premise and a conclusion. Both have to be true and both have to be valid, logically connected. And it's that one that's not stated that's often the problem. That's a good observation that Mark makes. All right. Matthew 19:9. You know that one by heart, don't you? Whoever puts away his wife, except for the cause of fornication, and marries another, commits adultery, and whoever marries the woman that's put away commits adultery. Now, here's our point. If fornication dissolves the marriage, as this position says, so that it no longer exists, once fornication takes place, can the innocent party now divorce their mate? No, there's no marriage. How can you divorce somebody you're not married to? But Jesus says, whoever divorces his wife except for that reason. So you know they've committed fornication, and you are now divorcing them. But wait, if fornication dissolved the marriage, you can't put away somebody that you're not married to. You can't quit a job that you don't have. Yes, sir. Here's their answer. They won't. That's what they say. If the fornication dissolves the marriage, so fornication is to adulterate a marriage. There's no marriage. Fornication took place. So when the second woman marries, or when that woman remarries, or somebody marries her, that's not adultery. But Ronnie's brought out an excellent point. Jesus says, whoever marries the woman commits adultery. How can that be if fornication dissolved the marriage? How can that be? All right, so that's a good observation Ronnie makes. Thank you, Ronnie. All right, so we ask this question. How many people are guilty of adultery? Let's look at Luke 16:18. Luke 16:18 is similar to Matthew 19. There's two good reasons for being familiar with it. Mark is also very valuable. But one of the reasons is sometimes in Matthew 19:9, you will see a footnote, like this version will leave out part of the verse, and they'll say some manuscripts don't have that last part of the verse. And so if somebody wants to camp on that, go to Luke 16:18. It's there. But the second reason is, this verse doesn't even mention the except clause. That's the second reason. And the reason Mark is valuable is because he talks about something Matthew did not. Matthew is written for Jews. Jewish women did not divorce Jewish men. Mark seems to have been written for Roman readers, Gentiles. Those women did divorce their husbands. And Mark talks about the woman doing the divorcing. So that's valuable to understand all three of these places in the Synoptic Gospels that these instructions are given. So Luke 16:18, how many people are guilty of adultery when someone divorces their mate and marries somebody else? How many? Four, right? So you got the original couple. That's two. They marry two other people. Jesus says, whoever marries the one divorced from a husband commits adultery. So the people they marry commit adultery. So you got four people guilty of adultery. The two original people and the people they marry. But if adultery dissolves the marriage of the original party so that they are both free to marry, how many of these would be guilty of adultery?
Zero.
Just the original two. That was Ronnie's point. So the other two people they marry wouldn't be guilty of adultery because they're not adulterating a marriage. There is no marriage. It was dissolved by the act of fornication according to the position. All right. Sometimes people appeal to Thayer. Thayer's Greek lexicon. You've heard it mentioned many times. Probably seen it in material that you've read. It's a famous lexicon edited by Joseph Henry Thayer. He's not the original one who came up with it. It's actually an addition, a revision of a fellow by the name of Grimm's work, but it's a renowned lexicon. And their lexicons are very useful. What they've done, these fellows who write these books, these lexicons, is they have consulted the materials, the documents available at the time of the New Testament documents, or if it's an Old Testament lexicon, the Old Testament documents. And they say, okay, here's that word. Now, when they find that word, say, in a official decree or in a personal letter, they find the same word that's in the Bible text. Do you have an idea how they decide what they meant by it? Context. That's how they decide. The very method that we're using to define those words in our study. They look at the letter, they look at the document. Oh, well, here's what it meant here. Here's another document. Oh, it had a slightly different meaning here. So when they write their lexicon, they say this word had 2, 3, 5 definitions. Where do they get that? Based on the available documents for that time period. And so Mr. Lexicon, when he does that, he, Art and Gingrich Lexicon, and there's others, are authorities about that kind of thing. Now, which one of those definitions your passage goes under, that's a matter of judgment. But got to be careful how we use lexicons. This is an illustration. Mr. Thayer defines to commit adultery to have unlawful intercourse with another's wife. I've capitalized that. It's not in Thayer. That's my capitals. With another's wife. So the person who's arguing this position would say, you can't commit adultery with your own wife. It's with another person's wife. But when fornication was committed, that woman is no longer the wife of somebody else. So you cannot commit adultery with her. We have pointed out in a previous class, class number 5. You see, I got C5 there. And so, again, if you got your hard copy, I've got mine right here with notes on it. If you got your hard copy, you may remember taking notes, and we talked about figures of speech as it pertains to the terms husband and wife. In the Bible, those terms, and today too, by the way, the term husband and wife can be used of present relationships, anticipated relationships, like Joseph and Mary, or past relationships, like Uriah and Bathsheba. If you want to go back and look at that, we've got the notes there in that lesson. Let me ask you a question. Did the Osteen family attend a funeral for the husband of Elizabeth yesterday?
Yes.
Is he still her husband? No. We're using that word just like we're talking about. He used to be. Obviously, he can't be her husband if he's dead. All right, so Mr. Thayer says, another's wife. Why don't we allow him the latitude of language that Bible writers use and we use to mean possibly one who was another's wife and not force a meaning to try to justify our view? To make this Thayer's support this idea, you'd have to say with one who is currently another's wife, or something like that. All right. So that's what is our question. How might Thayer scripturally use the term wife other than the woman to whom one is married, of course, of a past relationship? Okay? So be careful in the use of lexicons. I use them. They're very valuable, very helpful. So is an axe, but it can cut your foot off. So are your feet. They're good for running, but you can break a leg or an arm or a shoulder. So there are valuable tools, but sometimes those same tools can get us in trouble. All right. Any other comments before we move to the second? Yes, sir.
Not a common question. Just maybe I'm missing something, but what would be the practical application here? Why would somebody make that excuse, use this reason?
Because if you marry somebody that was not put away for fornication, but fornication was involved, there was no marriage, so when you sleep with that person, you're not guilty of fornication. You're not guilty of adultery. Say, but they were married before. Yeah, they were married, but they're not married, so for me to commit fornication with this person, they have to still be married. But there is no marriage because fornication dissolved it. Yes, sir?
So the definition, I'm late on this class, but the definition of fornication would be to commit adultery with someone that you're not married to, correct?
Now, there's two terms, adultery and fornication. Adultery, Romans 7 talks about adultery. Adultery involves a person who at least has been married. They don't have to be married now, but they have been, and in a lawful marriage, and they're bound by law to that person. If that person is dead, no law. Okay. The difference with fornication, the word fornication can include adultery, but it's more expansive. It's a more general term. Fornication can include unlawful sex between people who have never been married, or people who engage in homosexual or lesbian type sex, that kind of stuff. The word fornication is a more general word, but sometimes they're used interchangeably. We do the same thing. We use words interchangeably, and then sometimes we sort them out with specific definitions. So we've got to be careful on our definitions. You had a comment, Rodney? Right.
So Jesus said you
committed
adultery with your wife.
With your wife, that's right. Good point, Ronnie. And if you'll remind me, Jimmy, right? I've got, I think, another copy of the entire course if you're interested. So you can have that class five. I'd be glad to give you a copy.
Okay.
Yes.
I realize that's not what you're trying to do.
I know you're not. But we've got to be careful, and here's why, Ronnie. Watch my time here. If I'm on the other side of the argument, I'm going to say, Ronnie, that's not true. What if you kill your mate? Can you remarry? If you marry somebody after your mate's dead, are you committing adultery? So do you benefit from your sin? So, I'm not advocating killing somebody if you don't like them now. You're still guilty of murder, and I don't know how the Lord would look at that, but Romans 7 says you would not be committing adultery because that first mate's dead. I know what you're saying. It sounds strange to say you would benefit from your sin. In fact, the answer would be if you want to remarry, don't go get remarried until you commit fornication. And that's a good point you make. That would actually encourage fornication. Because I want to remarry, but I don't want to be guilty of adultery, so how can I do that? Well, go commit fornication. That severs the marriage. Now I can marry without guilt. And so Ronnie is pointing out a very good and basic point. Yes. It is.
Not wanting to follow God's law at all.
Good point. Good point.
So, trying to get them to understand God's law and how marriage is a covenant with God to be married to another person. It's like trying to get them to understand calculus when they don't accept math. It's
an excellent observation. The first two classes of our study dealt with that very point. The attitude toward, do I want to do what God wants to do or do I want to justify what I'm doing? Excellent observation. Good point. All right. Let's move to our next one. Got a few minutes left to deal with this one. One free, both free. I guess one of the first times I heard this one was by a gospel preacher whom I highly respected. And he's a good man. He converted a lot of people. But I think he was wrong on this. So what I'm saying is, just because the guy's a good guy and you like him and you could really benefit from a lot of his teaching doesn't mean he's right on marriage and divorce or on the church or on whatever it may be. And the same thing is true with this preacher that's standing before you, because you may like once in a while a sermon, so once in a while I get a good one. And because you may like one now and then doesn't mean I'm right on this. And so it's your job to examine everything. All right. So, when the divorce is on the grounds of, now put that in there. Maybe I should have put that in quotes. Note, the divorce is not one person putting away the other person for fornication. It's just fornication's involved somewhere. When the divorce is on the grounds of fornication, the innocent may remarry. Because, now you see that one above, both could remarry. But this is different. The innocent may remarry because no marriage bond exists. Now this one's going to end up in the same place. Both will be free to marry. It is like being bound by rope. So we agree that if a person puts away their mate for fornication, I would not agree with just the statement on the grounds of fornication, because that may mean that the fornicator severs the marriage. But if a person puts away their mate for fornication, I would agree that they can remarry, because there's no bond between the innocent party and the person they put away. But it's like a rope. If the rope is cut, both parties are free. So let me ask you a question. I told myself I wasn't going to ask questions, and here I'm doing it. But I'll answer my own question. But here, let me ask the question. How would you go about proving that when a person puts away their mate for fornication, that they're no longer bound by law to that mate? Romans 7 does not discuss that. Here's how I would answer it. Matthew 19, whoever puts away his wife for fornication, put your wife away for any other reason, when you remarry, you commit adultery. But if you put your wife for fornication, Jesus accepts that case. It's not adultery when you remarry. Based on Romans 7, the implication is you were no longer bound to that person. You are no longer bound to the person that you put away for fornication. If you were still bound to that person when you remarried, it would be adultery, Romans 7. So the implication is, there's a difference in inferring something and implying something. Implication is inheritance, built in. And so the implication is that when a person puts away their mate for fornication, they are no longer bound by law to that person. All right, so that's at least how I would approach it. But the argument is, well, if that person is free, and we would, whoever discuss, you're discussing this with at Hoses, we'd both agree on that. That person's free. How in the world can you say the other person is not free? When one's free, you got two people tied together, you cut the rope, they're both free. That's the position. All right. Now let's go back to Romans 7. We got this, well, I just have it here, Romans 7, about the, and we discussed it, class 13. So a woman is bound by law to the husband. I want to go to 1 Corinthians 7. Look at 1 Corinthians 7. All right, Romans 7. He discusses marriage and divorce. It's really a sub-subject to the main topic, which is their relationship to the law of Moses. But he uses marriage and divorce by illustration as to the jurisdiction of law. But in 1 Corinthians 7, the whole chapter is about marriage and divorce. Now, when you get to verse 39, so Paul wrote Romans. Paul wrote 1 Corinthians. Paul is discussing marriage in Romans 7. Paul is discussing marriage in 1 Corinthians 7. In Romans 7, a woman is bound by law to her husband as long as he lives. 1 Corinthians 7, same writer, same subject, same word. All right, look at it, verse 39. A wife is bound as long as her husband lives. That's almost an echo of Romans 7, isn't it? Now note, when will she be free? Free to be married. Here's the answer. If her husband is dead, then she's free. So if her husband is still alive, she is not free. Then how can he remarry? Matthew 19 implies if he put her away, if he's still alive, he puts her away for fornication. He is free. She is not. He's still alive. She didn't put him away for fornication. She committed fornication and he divorced her. She is not free to be married to whom she will. Now, is this bond that you're reading about here a physical bond or a legal bond? Legal bond. By law, Romans 7. Bound by law. So the by law doesn't occur here. but it does in Romans 7. Bound by law, legal bond. And so, bound by law to the husband. Remember we talked about words. Words are so critical. So I go get some contact cement. And I want to put something on the wall. So I say, I'm going to stick this to the wall. What do I mean by to? Contact. Contacting. But if I say the floor is perpendicular to the wall, is it contact? No, relationship. Reference. See? So in Romans 7, when we studied it, you were made to die to the law, verse 4. Not contact, reference. And the same is true. Bound by law to her husband is not contact like a rope, not physical. It's reference, in reference to her husband. All right. And so I'm out of time. Real quickly. I'm sorry, Greg. I mislooked at the clock. Secular example. You go buy a TV at Best Buy. Best Buy is under contract to the warranty, whatever, or the warranty company to fix that TV if it goes bad. You bring it home and you're watching a Western. Your son gets the BB gun and shoots the bad guy, busts the screen out. Now, is the guy, the other part of the contract still bound to fix it?
Yeah.
No. It's a legal bond. It's not a physical bond. And, of course, we have biblical examples. Jephthah vowed, and when you vow, you were under a bond to offer whatever came out of the doors of his house. Whatever came out of the doors of his house was under no bond. Same thing with the Jews. They bound themselves under an oath to kill Paul. Paul was under no bond. Legal bonds are not like physical bonds. And our time is up, so I'm bound to quit. All right. Thank you.